Good evening. It's good to see each and every one of you here this evening. I'd invite you to turn in your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, that's going to be our jumping off point in just a few moments. Hope that you've had a good Lord's Day so far. Hope that you were edified and encouraged by your time here this morning. Hope the things that we did were helpful to you in growing closer to God. You know my policy about running. I've mentioned it a few times. There are really, in my mind, only two reasons to run. Number one, you run in order to get pizza or some other sort of delectable delight, like donuts. And number two, you run if somebody's chasing you. That just seems to make sense. If they're chasing you, it's probably not for a good reason. You run away from that. Well, I'm going to make an amendment and add a third reason why you would run. You would run if there is a cause to run for. Saturday, there was a race, I think it was called Hope Continues, and it was a race supporting breast cancer awareness. Joe talked about this race in his invitation on Wednesday night. That's the first I had heard of it. And then Friday morning, when I was over at the MIMS, Lynn told me that they planned on running and that several other people planned on running. And so I decided, well, maybe I'll think about running. And I did. And I went into that race knowing that it would be fodder for tonight's lesson, for tonight's sermon. However, I did not recognize to what degree that would be true. We're going to be talking about encouragement this evening. And when I run, I need a lot of encouragement, because I do not like running. So the gun goes off. It's time to start running. And it kind of happens that I was not particularly ready for it. It was supposed to start at 8, and I think the gun went off a few minutes after 8. And so we were all kind of just sitting around waiting for it. And I was talking to Joe and to Jack and asking them what their plans were. And told Jack that he needed to stay a little bit away from Joe. You may remember Wednesday night, Joe's backup plan was to knock Jack down if it came to that, so that he would not be last. And fortunately, I don't think he had to use that. But anyways, the gun goes off and we start running, and I've got in my mind that I'm gonna try to run about an 8:30 pace, which would have hopefully gotten me around 25, 26 minutes. And that's really what I was aiming for. Less than half a mile in, my earbuds go out. I have no music, and I need that music to keep me motivated. I had a special playlist made up to motivate me as I'm running. And so that's the first bad sign that this race is not going to go very well. No music, no motivation as I'm running. And then it's really, really cold, right? It was, what was it, like 37, 39, something, or somewhere around there when the race started. So it's pretty cold. And on top of that, I've got terrible circulation to my extremities. That's just always been the case. And so when my hands get cold, they start to kind of cramp up. You've seen people when they've got arthritis really bad, they get their fingers really cramp up. That's kind of how my fingers started to look and started to feel. In fact, I couldn't feel them at all. And so not only did I not have my music and was it cold, but I couldn't check the pacing on my phone with my running app because my phone was not recognizing my fingers as I tried to touch it. And so I had no clue whether or not I was keeping that 8:30 pace or not. Then about 1.5 miles in, that's when my back really started hurting. Back in May and really March to May, I was dealing with a really bad back issue where any time I tried to run or do any action that required me doing continuous motion, my back would really start to flare up. Well, I had been free of that for a few months now, but about 1.5 miles in, I really started to feel that in my lower back. And so at this point, there's every reason for me to quit. There's the hills that we're running. There's the potholes on the ground. There was one hill that I'm going up, and you know, the road is kind of slanted on either side, and I'm on the side of the road because there's a turn coming up, and so I want to be on the side of the road that's going to be most conducive for me to be able to turn but the road's slanted and I'm running up a hill and I'm kind of running at an angle and my legs are tired and so I'm trying to keep myself straight and not fall over and I don't know, it wasn't going well. Every reason for me to quit. But then there's these people along the way that are cheering you on at every corner, at every turn. They have these stations set up where there's these people that are cheering for you, encouraging you to keep going on. Not only that, but as you look around and everybody else is running, they're suffering along with you, and they've all got the same goal. Everybody wants to finish. Maybe some have a goal of doing it faster, more efficiently, but we've all got the same goal of finishing this race. And so all of that serves to encourage me. I had every reason in my mind to quit, and I thought about quitting several times, but I didn't quit because of the encouragement that I was receiving along the way. And that's really what I want us to begin to think about this evening as we dive into our lesson. We're in this race, we're in this journey, we're all traveling it together, and it is a long race. 3.1, 2 miles, that's not long for many of the people in this room. We've got people in this room that will run 6 miles before they even wake up in the morning. Not me. 3.12 whatever it is, miles. That's a long way for me to run. I was a sprinter in high school, which meant I ran anywhere from 100 meters to 400 meters. Well, this is what? 1,600 meters times 3, do the math, 4,800 meters. This is a long distance for me. And again, the hills, not easy. In Texas, everything is flat, right? You got a little speed bump in the road. That is a hill in Texas. We're not used to elevation changes, especially when we're running. And so, as we're running this race, this journey in life, there are going to be hills, there's going to be potholes, there's going to be frigid conditions, circumstances that make it difficult. There are going to be things that try to take away our motivation. There's going to be detractors along the way, whether they come from the voices in our own head or from the voices around us telling us to quit. And we've got to encourage one another along the way. That's what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. I appreciate what he says here. In light of the fact that the day of the Lord is coming, in light of the fact that some will obtain salvation through the Lord Jesus Christ, while others will face wrath, Paul says, 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and in verse 11, therefore encourage one another and build one another up just as you are doing. Paul recognized they had a habit of encouraging one another. They had a practice of encouraging one another. And yet he still admonishes them, still encourages them, and urges them to keep doing this more and more. Brothers and sisters, that's what we need to do as well. I think we have a practice, have a habit of encouraging one another. We do that very well. We care for and tend to the sick among us very well. We look at those around and see where people are missing and see maybe where people are discouraged and we reach out to them. We do that very well. And yet, I can say, along with Paul, to keep on doing it just as we are doing. A couple verses later, he says in verse 14, and we urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with them all. Let's be honest, there are those among us who struggle more than others. There are those among us who seem to have a harder time in this life, whether that be because of physical ailments, because of circumstances, whether that be just because of where they are in their faith. There are some among us that seem to have a harder time and need some special attention. But let's be honest, we all fit into these categories at times, do we not? There are times when each of us is idle. There are times when each of us is weak, each of us is faint, and each of us needs encouragement. And so we need to encourage one another, all the more as we see the day drawing near. That's exactly what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 3. Will you turn there with me? Hebrews chapter 3, the Hebrew writer is addressing a people who are facing difficult circumstances, trying circumstances. They are facing suffering and persecution for the sake of being Christians. They are being ostracized by their kinsmen being put out from among their family, among their friends, because they no longer practice and believe and do the things that they did when they were of the Jewish faith. And so they are facing some trying times. And though they have not yet faced persecution to the point of bloodshed, we learn in chapter 12, that certainly would be coming for them as well. And so the Hebrew writer recognizes the need to encourage these brethren so that they do not fall by the wayside, so that they do not turn back away from God, so they don't get to that 1.5 mile, 26 mile mark and say, I'm quitting just before the end. Hebrews chapter 3, beginning in verse 7, Hebrew writer says, therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, on the day of testing in the wilderness, where your fathers put me to the test and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore I was provoked with that generation, and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. The Hebrew writer quotes here from Psalm 95, and this psalm is looking back on events in Israel's history, particularly as Moses is leading them out of Egypt and through the wilderness, trying to lead them to the promised land. And yet, what is the story? What is the refrain that we hear over and over again? That they rebel against God. They grumble and they complain against God. They put God to the test time and time again. And ultimately, they're not able to enter into that land. The background for this begins in Exodus chapter 15. Place a marker here in Hebrews chapter 3, because we're going to be coming back here. But I want us to look back in Exodus chapter 15 beginning, and see what sort of testing and what sort of circumstances this wilderness generation, what sort of ways they tested God and what sort of circumstances characterized this wilderness generation. Exodus 15, and in verse 22, Moses has just led them across the Red Sea as God has parted the sea before them, allowed them to cross over safely, and then has closed it back up over the Egyptians. Exodus 15 and verse 22, they are now traveling through the wilderness of Shur, and this is what it says. Exodus 15, beginning in verse 22. Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness, and they found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah, because it was bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. Marah means bitter. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying, if you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his eyes, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord your healer. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. So here's a situation where they're traveling in the wilderness. They recognize that they have no water. They've been going for 3 days, have no water. They cry out because they do come to water, but the water they come to, they're not able to drink because it is bitter. They cry out, they grumble against God, and God answers them. And God says, you know what, if you will just be diligent, and if you'll obey me, and if you'll trust me, I'm going to provide for you, and I'm not going to bring upon you any of the diseases or the plagues that I bring upon the Egyptians. And so it ends with God giving them this water. There is this occasion where they've got these 12 springs of water and these 70 palm trees, this oasis of sorts where God is providing water for them. And so you'd think after this occasion, they'd recognize that God has their back, that God is going to get them through, that they are going to be able to enter the promised land, and God is going to lead them on that journey and provide for them along the way. Well, the next thing that we read, beginning in chapter 16 in verse 1, it says, they set out from Elim, and
All the congregation of the people came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And on the 15th day of the second month, after they had departed out of the land of Egypt, and the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, and the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." And so again, this people, just a few days later, begins to grumble against God and against Moses because they are facing some trying circumstances, and they do not have the food that they would wish to have. And so they think back to the days when they were in Egypt with rose-colored glasses. You remember they were slaves in Egypt, but they're thinking back and remember all the food that we had and all the meat that we had to eat. We ate bread to the full. Well, really, it wasn't like that for them. But that's what they're looking back. That's what it's like looking back with rose-colored glasses. And so they complain, they grumble against God once again, put God to the test once more, and God says that he's going to give them this bread from heaven that eventually they come to call manna, and that they were to gather it for several days. And for 6 days they would gather, or rather for 5 days they would gather it. 6 days they would gather it, and on the sixth day they would gather twice as much, so that on the seventh day, on the Sabbath day, they could keep that day holy to the Lord, and they would trust God, knowing that he would provide for them enough, and that it would not spoil to the next day. He would provide for them enough for them to have to eat on the Sabbath. And so this was a statute throughout their generation as they went throughout the wilderness, that God was going to provide manna for them, and they were to trust in him to do so. Well, again, you'd think, after this situation, after this circumstance, God has given them water, God has given them food. Yes, they're facing trying circumstances, but each time God has provided for them, you'd think that they'd get it now. But they still don't get it. They continue to grumble against God and put God to the test. Chapter 17, beginning in verse 1, it says, "All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' And Moses said, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?' But the people thirsted for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, 'Why do you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and to kill our children and our livestock with thirst?' So Moses cried to the Lord, 'What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you, and there on the rock at Horeb, you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, and the people will drink.' And Moses did so in sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, 'Is the Lord even among us or not?'" And this last phrase, "Is the Lord even among us?" this really gets to the heart of what's going on here in each of these three stories. They're doubting God, doubting his ability to carry them through, doubting his ability to bring them safely to the promised land, just as he had promised. And they are ready to give up. They're ready to go back. They're ready just to call it quits, and they would rather return back to the land of Egypt. And so these three times they put God to the test, and this is really characteristic of their time throughout the wilderness. These are not the only times they're going to put God to the test, but this characterizes this the people of God in this wilderness generation, facing trying circumstances, yes, but not willing to trust God, not willing to keep going, to keep on keeping on, wanting to turn back and wanting to quit. We get to Numbers chapter 13, and this is really a sad story. Even amidst all their grumbling and all their complaining, God has continued to provide for them, continued to lead them, and here he is ready finally at last to lead them into the promised land. And so God, through Moses, instructs them to send men out and to survey the land, to spy out the land, to see what is there, to see what they're up against, and to know what type of land it is that God is bringing them to. And so Moses sends out the spies. You remember the story? He sends out, what is it, is it 13 spies? Is that right? 13 spies? 12 spies. 12 spies he sends out. And 10 of those spies, what do they say? After going into the land, after seeing that it is indeed a good land, and seeing that it does produce this marvelous sort of vegetation, and they bring back this single cluster of grapes that they've got to carry on this pole because it's so large and just so it's showing some of the vast vegetation of the land. And everything is good. Everything is exactly as God said it would be. It is truly a land that is flowing with milk and honey. It is going to be a land where they can live and where they can prosper, just as God had promised. But there's a little problem. It says the descendants of Anak were there. These were some large people. These were ultimately the descendants of the Nephilim, the sons of the descendants of the spawn between the angels and man, back from Genesis chapter 6. And so these are some fairly large people. And so you're one of these spies, and you go into the land, and you see it's a good land, but you also see there's some obstacles. There's some giants here. There's some frigid conditions that we have to face. And they ultimately decide we're going to give up. We're going to quit. We're not going to enter into the land. And so 10 of the spies come back, and they say, we can't go in. It is a good land, but the people are too big. They are too large. We are too small before them. We're just like grasshoppers before them. It was only Caleb and Joshua that came back with the report and that said, let's go up and at once and occupy it, for we are able to overcome it. But then, that wilderness generation, they decide to listen to the report of the other spies rather than to Caleb and to Joshua. And so ultimately, they don't enter the land. They rebel against God, and chapter 14 records that rebellion for us, and ultimately God's decision that this generation would not enter into the promised land. What's the wilderness generation? Characterized by grumbling and complaining, kind of sort of like I was doing during that race. But unlike me, they quit. They didn't allow the voice of reason. They didn't allow Moses and Joshua and Caleb, those who were saying we can do it and God is with us. Let's keep going. Let's keep pressing on. They did not allow those voices to prevail. Rather, they listened to the detractors, those who were saying it's not worth it. Let's just give up. And so the Hebrew writer, he uses this generation with their circumstance, all the issues that they're facing. And he says, don't be like that generation. Don't be like that generation who in the midst of trial, in the midst of trying circumstances, gave up. Yes, I know you are facing the seizure of property, the loss of your homes. I know you are facing ostracization from your kin and from your family, from your friends. I know you feel like an outcast. And I know things are only going to get worse for you. But don't be like that wilderness generation. So back in Hebrews chapter 3, and in verse 12 beginning, this is the application that the Hebrew writer makes. Hebrews 3, beginning in verse 12, the Hebrew writer says, take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil and unbelieving heart, leading you to fall away from the living God. But exhort one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have come to share in Christ if we hold our original confidence firm to the end. As it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. And so the Hebrew writer's application is, you see this wilderness generation, you see where they failed to enter the land, they gave up, they grumbled, they tested God, they lacked faith in God. You don't be like him, like them. And what you need to do is you need to encourage one another. You need to exhort one another. As long as the day is yours, as long as you have the opportunity to do so, you encourage one another. And that's exactly what we need to do. Recognizing that our journey, we're going to face times of trial. We're going to face circumstances that are unfavorable. We're going to come face to face with giants, as it were. And there will be detractors along the way telling us to turn back. In light of all of that, we need to be the ones encouraging one another, exhorting one another to continue on, to press on, keep on keeping on, and to finish the race. And so in the time that we have left, I just want to share three ways in which we can encourage one another. Three ways, and then the lesson will be yours. Number one, we need to remind them, we need to remind our brothers and sisters that they matter. You remember in Numbers chapter 16, the rebellion of Korah. This was another time where God was put to the test by this wilderness generation and many people died. But you remember what that rebellion was all about? Basically, Korah came to Moses and to Aaron and he said, who made you so important? Who made you better than all of us that you guys get to have these exalted positions? And then later on, from what Moses says, it is evident that Korah not only wants to be a Levite and to have the privilege and the opportunity, the great responsibility to care for the things of the temple and the tabernacle at the time, what would become the temple, but he also wanted the priesthood as well. He wanted the ability to offer sacrifices. And really what you get from Korah is a sense of arrogance, a sense of envy. But you also get, maybe he felt that he wasn't appreciated. Maybe he wasn't happy with his role. Maybe he wasn't feeling very important. And I think we can relate to that at times. If we can take a positive lesson from the life of Korah, it would be this. As that we all want to do more. We all want to be appreciated. We all want people to look at us and appreciate what we do. And maybe we're coming at it from more of an innocent basis than what Korah was. But I think we all feel that at times. Show of hands. Who feels underappreciated ever? I'll wait until we're all honest with ourselves. There we go. There are times in our lives where each and every one of us feel that we're not being appreciated for the things that we do. Maybe that we don't matter, or that we're not important, or that people don't care about us enough. We all face that at times. And I think that's the reason why we need to remind other people that they matter. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, you remember the context in the book of 1 Corinthians. This is a group that was very divided, divided over everything, divided over who baptized them, divided over what spiritual gifts they had. Even when they came together for the Lord's Supper, that unifying covenant meal that was supposed to bring them together, they were even divided in that. They were divided over who had better spiritual gifts. They saw spiritual gifts as a means to elevate themselves rather than as a means to bring glory to God and to spread his kingdom. And so they're bickering with one another about whose gift is better, who is more important, who is the MVP of this team, of this body. And so Paul goes into this discussion, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, beginning of verse 12. Just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one Spirit we were all baptized into one body. Jews and Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one Spirit. Listen, we've all come to this body. We are all now part of Christ. All baptized by the same Spirit. All come to drink of this same Spirit, to have this same life. And so it doesn't matter which spiritual gift you have. It doesn't matter what your background is, whether you're a Jew or a Greek, whether you were slave or free. We're all equal in Christ. We're all part of this same body. The implication is that nobody is more important than the other. And so he goes on to this into this discussion that if the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, that I do not belong to the body. Well, what's the foot saying? Because I'm not a hand, because I don't serve this function or this role, I'm just not important. Or if the ear should say that because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body. Paul says that would not make it any less part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God has arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The point as Paul is making is all matter, all are important, all have a function and a role. And therefore, the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor the head to the feet, I have no need of you. And then Paul goes on to talk about the less honorable parts receiving greater honor. And the reason for this, verse 25, is that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. So again, in the backdrop of the division, in the backdrop of elevating oneself over another and saying that you don't matter, you're not important, or you yourselves looking at the other member and saying, well, I just don't measure up because I'm not an eye, or I'm not a hand, or I'm not an arm, whatever it be, and so I'm not important. Paul says, no, you're all important. You all matter, you all have a function, you all have a role. And I think we need to remind people of that. That just because you're not me does not mean that you don't matter. And just because I'm not you doesn't mean that I'm not as important as you. We need to reaffirm each other. We need to let each other know that we matter, or that they matter. And the parts that are seem to be less honorable, we need to hold up in greater honor. Those people who are weak and who are idle among us, we need to pay special attention to them, to reaffirm them and let them know that they matter. Well, how do we do that? Well, I think one of the ways that we do that is found in verse 26. The application Paul makes is if one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. One way we remind people that they matter is that we share with them in their highs and in their lows. That when things are going well in their life, that we are rejoicing along with them, that we're congratulating them and letting them know that we are happy for them and their circumstance in life. But equally as important, when things are going bad, when they're laid up in the hospital, when they're going through a bad divorce, when they've got family issues or a death in the family, when they are facing struggles in their faith, we need to be there with them. We need to put our arms around them and let them know that we care. We need to weep with them. We need to do as Paul says, echoing this statement here, Romans chapter 12 and verse 15. We need to rejoice with those who rejoice. We need to weep with those who weep. One way that we need to show people that they matter to us, and they matter to the rest of the body, is to share life with them, through the good and through the bad. Another way that we remind them that they matter is to reaffirm the good things that they are doing. People need to hear not only that they are important, but the things that they are doing are important. And again, in 1 Corinthians 12, Paul is talking about the various roles, the various functions that each member has. And we need to reaffirm each other and let each other know that the things that you are doing are important. The things that you are doing are appreciated. And that's exactly Paul's pattern. That was his practice. We already referenced 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 11, where he says, encourage one another just as you are doing. Paul had a habit of that, of pointing out the good things that the churches were doing that he was writing to, or the individuals were doing that he was writing to. He let them know that he appreciated them and the work that they were doing. Earlier in the letter of Thessalonians, he has already commended them both for their faith and for their love, which was known throughout the world. We need to commend other people. We need to let them know that the job that they are doing is important and is significant, whatever that job is, whatever role, whatever function they are fulfilling, that it is important and it is appreciated. That's the exact same sort of thing that Jesus does. You remember in his letters to the seven churches in the book of Revelation, as John records those things, and writes those things through the inspiration of Jesus. In each of those letters, he always has something that he's commending the congregation for, the things that they are doing right. I think with the exception of one congregation, he always has something good to say, something to commend about what they are doing. And I think we can learn from that. We need to be people who reaffirm others, the role that they play, the things that they do. Whether that be, I really appreciate the fact that you sent me a text message when I was sick, or that you came to visit me in the hospital. Or I really appreciate the way that you teach the children's classes, and I know that that's not always easy. Or the way that you prepare for the vacation Bible school. Or the way that you clean the building. Or the way that you do the lawn. Or the way that you lead singing. Or lead prayer. Or prepare the elements for the Lord's Supper. Or whatever it is that we are finding to do, we need to tell people we appreciate the work that they're doing, and that work is important for what we're doing here. So number one, to encourage one another on this journey, we need to remind people that they matter. You know, as I was running on that race, I got to thinking, what's the point? I'm not going to get first place. I'm not going to get any sort of you know, tangible prize. I'm just another person in the crowd. But to somebody, I mattered. To somebody, I was an example. To somebody, I was a help. And to somebody, I showed what that race was really for. We were recognizing and trying to spread the word that breast cancer is a terrible thing and spread awareness for that. And so I mattered to somebody. Number two, to encourage people, I think we need to remind them that they're not alone. We need to remind them that they're not alone. I always start races off really quickly. I'm terrible at setting a pace for myself. And again, I've got an excuse in this race because I didn't have my phone to help me set my pace. But I started off, I was at like an 8-minute pace, and I was able to slow down to about an 8:30 pace before I was unable to use the phone. But what that gave me the benefit of was getting past Lana Kate. And getting past Roan and Lynn and everybody else and Joe. And then when I finally slowed down because I wasn't running at the proper pace, I think it was around that 1.5 mile point, Roan, that you passed me. Lana Kate, I think you passed me maybe a little over 0.5 mile. It was pretty early on. And she shakes her head yes. It may have even been before that, I don't know. But just seeing other people running along with me, people that I knew, we all had the same goal. Asa, did you pass me at one point? Asa's not here. That's right. Asa passed me, I think, too. But knowing that we all had this same goal and that I wasn't alone and that we were all in this together and that if I dropped back even further, that there would be other people that I could run with, it's helpful to know that we're not alone. I think as we run in this journey that we call life, sometimes we begin to feel lonely. And sometimes we begin to feel like we're the only ones going through whatever it is that we're going through at the time. And nobody else has been there. Nobody else knows what it is, how it feels. We need to remind people that they're not alone. First of all, we need to remind people that God is with them. Remember the complaints. Remember where the Israelites are coming from. Is God not with us? Is he not among us? We need to remind and affirm people, yes, he is with us. And even though the circumstances may dictate to us, may seem like he's not there, we need to remind him that he is there. That's the point the Hebrew writer's making. Even as you're going through these trials, God is still with you. And in fact, these trials may be because God is testing you, and He's trying to build you up and discipline you just as a father would his child. Hebrew writer reminds his readers, Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, he says, keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. Verse 6, so we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? We need to recognize that God has not forsaken us. God is with us, and He will be with us, even as we go through the trial, even as we go through the hardship, the struggle, even as we face that hill, step in that pothole, twist our ankle, feel the back pain. God is there as we run this race of life. But not only is God there, others are there as well. The Hebrew writer makes that point. Hebrews chapter 12, and in verse 12, he says, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, and he just talked about people like Abel and Noah and Abraham and Moses and Samson and Jephthah and all the other people that he has just written about, all those people who had gone through all of these things, who had faced hardships and trials. Some people were sawn in two and lost loved ones and in prison and killed. All of these people, they have gone and are going through the same things that you are. They are witnesses, not only to the race that you're running as they're cheering you on, but witnesses in their own lives that God fulfills His promises. They are witnesses that it can be done, that you can keep on running. Peter also makes this point in his epistle, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. He says, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Verse 9, resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. And after you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you to His eternal glory in Christ, will Himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. To Him be the dominion forever and ever. Amen. Peter's writing to a group of people, like the Hebrew writer, who are facing trials, fiery trials, Peter calls them. They are being slandered, they are being beaten, they are being ostracized, they are being put in jail. All of these things they are facing because they are Christians. And Peter reminds his readers that other people have faced these same sorts of suffering. And that's helpful, isn't it? When you know that somebody else aches like you ache, when somebody else hurts like you hurt, when somebody else is gasping for air just as you are gasping for air, but there is comfort and consolation in knowing that you're doing it together and that you're not alone and that you're not the only one that has faced this. We need to remind other people that they're not alone, that we're with them and that we empathize with them. Thirdly and finally, we need to remind people, if we're going to encourage them, we need to remind people of the prize. We need to remind people of what is waiting for them. When they get that goal, when they finish the race, there's a prize at the end of the race. And no, it may not be a physical trophy, at least it wasn't in my circumstance, but that prize for me was knowing that I finished. And knowing that I ran for a good cause. That was my prize. We need to remind people that there's a prize at the end of the race. Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 13 beginning, Hebrew writer speaks of the promises of God. And he says, Hebrews 11, verse 13, it says, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. And if they had been thinking of a land that they had gone out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared for them a city. This is the city that Abraham was waiting for. That city with foundations, whose designer and builder is God. We need to look forward to that city. We need to look forward to the prize of being with God in eternity, because that is our prize. People think of heaven and they conjure up ideas about what heaven will be like, and you'll have all this wealth, and maybe for you, if you really enjoy cheeseburgers, heaven is a place with eternal cheeseburgers. Or if it is cars, if it is money, if it is sitting and watching NFL football, or if you're in the South, it is sitting on Saturday and watching the SEC football. If that is what heaven is for you, that is what heaven will be. But heaven is far greater than any superficial thing that we could think of. It is far greater than any possession, any earthly pleasure, anything that gives us joy in this life, worldly speaking. Heaven, and the prize of heaven, is the ability to be with God for eternity, to be in His presence, to experience life abundantly in the presence of the life giver. That is what heaven is. That is the prize. And so we look for that prize. We seek that prize. Not just because we're going to have a mansion somewhere someday. God describes it to us in those terms because those are terms that we can understand. But the real joy, the real prize of heaven is that God is there and we are there with Him. And so we look forward to that prize and we remind other people of that prize, just as Jesus looked forward to that prize. Again, Hebrews chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely and run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despised the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus kept on, even in the face of a cross, even in the face of the most trying circumstances that we could imagine. He despised all the shame, all the ridicule, because He was looking forward to the joy of once again being with the Father, the joy of completing His mission, which would be, as God says through the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 53, that He sees all of His descendants before Him. That all of us get to come and to be with Him. That was the joy that Christ was waiting for. He was looking forward to the prize. And that's what we need to do as well. And that's what we need to help others do. We need to tell them of that inheritance, as Peter described in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 3, that inheritance that is kept for us in heaven, as imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven. We need to tell people. There's a prize at the end of this race. The prize is not the goal. The goal is to finish the race to the best of our ability, glorifying God along the way. But the prize of being with God in eternity. People need to be reminded of that. Because if they forget the prize, if they forget what's waiting for them, they will not have the motivation to endure and to continue. And so we're going to encourage one another each and every day, as long as it is called today. If we're going to not be like the wilderness generation, help our brothers and sisters do the same. We need to remind them that they matter. Remind them that they're not alone. We need to remind them of the prize. We're about to sing the song of invitation. Sometimes we call it the song of encouragement. And we call it that because we are trying to encourage people to come forward, trying to encourage people to make their lives right with God, make themselves right with Christ, their King, whether that is because they have never been part of His kingdom, have not begun to run that race, or whether it is because they've begun to run the race, seen the hills, felt the cold, seen the giants, and given up. So I sing this song of encouragement. I encourage you. If you are idle this evening, if you are weak, or if you just need to begin the race, and if we can help you with that, we ask you to come forth this evening as we stand and as we sing.